Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. For our first story this program, I'm going to talk about an article that just came out in The Economist about a new drug. And this is, you know, an important breakthrough. So let's start with, yes, this is a good thing. And yes, this is a disease that has been ignored and hasn't been sexy and hasn't been funded. So there's a lot of pain and suffering that probably we should have been working on for the last, 30 or 40 years. But that's finally changing. And what disease could I possibly be talking about in this over-medicated society? Well, I'm talking about endometriosis, which goes way back. It was first described in 1690 by a German physician, Daniel Schrön, and he was describing a patient with ulcers throughout her peritoneum, bladder, intestines, uterus, and cervix. And since it was 1690, I'm assuming this was an autopsy or an anatomy specimen, but it's, oh, look at this. This doesn't look normal. So what is endometriosis? It's when the lining of the uterus actually leaves the uterus, and this tissue is it's sort of like stem cells, all right? Every month in a woman during her fertility period, during her fertility years, she grows a nice thick mattress for the fertilized egg. And then if no egg shows up to occupy it, she sheds it. And that tissue, therefore, has to grow and die and grow and die and grow and die on a pretty short cycle. It has to get ready in about 15 days to receive that egg. Now, inside the uterus, that's not a problem. That's what's supposed to happen. But if fragments of that get coughed out through the eustachian tubes, they end up in the wide world, the wild west of the abdominal cavity. And that abdominal cavity has a lining, and it has a layer of skin that goes over all the organs. And these endometrial implants can actually, they're stem cells, right? So they find a good, gets nestle up somewhere warm near a blood vessel, infiltrate the blood vessel, and grow every month, and then shed every month. And there's one thing I can tell you, the peritoneum does not like. The nerves that line the inside of the abdominal cavity do not like blood. And anything blood-like hurts like crazy. So in a situation like this, you have a monthly cycle of pain. It can also implant on the cervix and cause hemorrhage during menstruation. It can cause inflammation, scar tissue, infertility. It's a nasty chronic disease, and it affects a lot of women. World Health Organization says something like 10% of women are affected by that. Now, I'm not sure it's that high, but it's pretty darn high, and it's pretty darn incapacitating. And so things are just changing. A clinical trial of the first non-hormonal, non-surgical treatment for endometriosis is showing promising results. Now, this trial was started in 2023, so this is a preliminary report. But it grew out of taking closer looks at the endometriosis lesions. And during diagnostic laparoscopies, which is where doctors go in through the abdominal wall and get down to these endometrial implants, they found that patients with peritoneal endometriosis, about 80% of cases have that, had higher levels of a chemical called lactate in their pelvises. This is lactic acid that's produced when the body breaks down glucose anaerobically. And you can get a stitch when you're running. You can get pain in your muscles. Lactic acid is also, if it's in the blood, a marker for bacterial infection, because guess what? bacteria all poop lactic acid. The way they generate energy for themselves creates lactic acid as a byproduct, just the way that the way we generate energy for ourselves creates CO2 as a byproduct. It's inevitable part of the physiology. So the researchers thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder if the lactate here is acting like the lactate that we see in cancer tissue, where cancer cells proliferate uncontrollably. So they made the connection, and they said, well, let's find a drug that lowers lactic acid. And this is a case of repurposing an old drug. So they found a drug that's currently used in cancer patients. It's called dichloroacetate, and it's it's been tested and shown to be safe and effective. There are children who have a rare metabolic disorder, hereditary, of course. Almost all of these metabolic disorders are hereditary, that causes excess lactic acid to build up in the blood because they can't get rid of it. So they took some women with endometriosis and they treated them with DCA, and they found lesser pain and a better quality of life. As I said, this is a very preliminary study. So next step comes a larger cohort with a placebo. But this is a really serious disease. So if you look at the number of disability adjusted life years for all of the women who miss work, who have to stay home, who aren't able to do their normal activities, and you cost that out, you know, just like those studies where they cost out what childcare actually costs, and it turns out to be like millions of dollars of purchased services a year if you had to buy it. Well, maybe millions is an exaggeration, but a lot of money. I don't remember the exact figures. One of the other problems is that this disease is invisible, right? First of all, it occurs in women. A study that was published recently in Britain, the Journal of Health Communication, interviewed women at different stages of obtaining a diagnosis. The average woman takes 10 years to get a diagnosis of endometriosis in England. It's probably lower here because it's probably lower in white women and women with the privilege of health insurance here. I'm not so sure about women who are not in that position, but it's a hard process. It almost always requires surgically, and finding biomarkers would be great. So there's a French company called Zwig that claims to have found a solution. It looks for micro NRAs, which appear in the saliva of women with endometriosis. So microRNAs are just starting to be explored. We all know about RNA now, RNA viruses, RNA turning into proteins. These microRNAs are much shorter. And up until recently, we haven't really known they existed, and we thought they were just broken up RNA, but actually they are control factors for all sorts of things. And apparently endometriosis is one of them. So they found specific microRNAs in saliva of women with endometriosis. And so they've got a test that's a saliva test, and we're looking at possibility of having a way to screen large swaths of the population much more cheaply and without invasive surgery. So that's a big plus. But my regular listeners know that whenever I smell bacteria, I think microbiome. So when I was looking at this lactate produced in where it shouldn't be, I'm like, that sounds like something to do with the microbiome. I wonder if people have studied the microbiome of the uterus. And so I did a little Google Scholar search, by the way, scholar.google.com, invaluable. And what I found was a number of articles published in the last 2 or 3 years that now acknowledge not only is there gut dysbiosis, right, which is irritable bowel syndrome, there's vaginal dysbiosis, which is either yeast infections or bacterial vaginosis, both unpleasant. There's also endometrial dysbiosis. So the wrong bacteria in a place that where they shouldn't be is treated as an invading army, and it sets up inflammation and it alters the cell profiles. In the case of endometriosis, obviously turning on some migratory capabilities that allow for the escape of the endometrial tissue and the implantation on, you know, non-target tissues. So it's almost acting a little bit like a cancer because the signaling of either the inflammation or the bacteria itself is messing up the programming. So what we're seeing is a revolution in the way we think about disease, especially chronic disease. Maybe it's not an infection, but it's a colonization, and it's a change in the temperature, if you will, that creates climate change in a complex system. And climate change, as we are all learning, as in climate change and weather variability, is nothing to mess with and is probably the cause of lots of diseases. So I love that they've got a drug that blocks lactic acid. That's a great thing. Bravo. Of course, drug discovery is what funds all of the basic research that eventually allows us to understand disease and maybe find ultimately less expensive solutions for managing it. I just was curious enough about this and had enough time this afternoon preparing for the show to see if I could find what's normally growing in the healthy endometrial microbiome. And it was very interesting. Pretty much what's growing in a healthy gut. You've got lactobacillus, you've got Barnesiella, you've got a little bit of Gardnerella, a little bit of things that you wouldn't think would be so great, like Shigella, by the way. We're having a bit of a Shigella outbreak in our community at the moment, so wash your hands before eating. But lots of the usual suspects. What we start to see in endometriosis is a bunch of bacteria that just aren't normally there. And these are ones I've never seen, but that I'm not a bacteriologist, so that's no surprise. But it's probably really significant that there are, in fact, profiles, bacterial profiles. And we now have the technology to take a little bit of endometrial tissue. We may be even able to use something like a used tampon and send it off to the lab and look at the footprint of the bacteria and say this person's at risk for endometriosis and actually have the ability to try to reboot the endometrial microbiome and not just treat the disease with a drug, but actually see that disease like an iceberg on the horizon and steer around it. And that's what gets my vote for the future of medicine. Let's go now to our next activity, and that's going to be listener email. So our first email comes from Kathy in Hollister, who writes, do you do active release therapy for tendon issues after a THR or any other suggestive therapies? Now, this is a psoas tendon release. That's what THR is. The psoas tendon release has been suggested by my orthopedic doctor after 2 years of issues with lifting my leg. I've been referred to you for some helpful assistance by my sister-in-law who's seen you in Santa Cruz. So Kathy has basically asked me about something that I need a lot more information to really be able to help her, but I do want to let her know that help is available. First of all, age is really important because your tendons become tighter and more rigid. And what happens in this tight psoas tendon is that it snaps when you stand up. People usually have problems standing up or stepping up without having pain. And the people who are most likely to get this, otherwise known as psoas syndrome, are often dancers or high jumpers, and they've overused the muscle and the tendon. It can, kicking sports, and if you're an adolescent and you're getting a growth spurt, it can be a really significant source of pain. The snapping psoas tendon is the big deal. But I went and looked at the surgeries to see how effective they were after seeing Kathy's mail, and I was going to suggest that before she makes that decision, she decide whether she has femoral antiversion. I'll explain that in a moment, because looking at retrospective studies of all of these hip procedures done for psoas tendon release, what the researchers found was that the people with the femoral antiversion did well. The ones who had the procedure who did not have the antiversions did less well from the surgery. They had less chance of success because the thing that the surgery is fixing wasn't probably the source of the problem, and other things should have been done beforehand. But of course, if you don't know that, if you don't scan for it. So what is femoral antiversion? It's a condition in which the center of the femoral neck, which is, if you go and look up femur and look at the picture of it, you'll see that it's sort of shaped like a hook a little bit. It has about a 45-degree angle and then a ball on the end of the short arm of that angle. That's what's going into the hip socket. So if you were to draw a line through the center of the femoral neck, just where the center of that half ball is coming out, it should point to the center of the hip socket. But if you have femoral antiversion, the center of the femoral neck actually pushes forward, and this causes the knee and the foot on that side to rotate or twist towards the middle of the body, and that causes it to snag on the deep tendon that goes from the back of the pelvis across the lower body and onto the front of the femur, and that's the pulley that lifts your leg, flexes your hip. So I would say that doing acupuncture, doing physical therapy, looking, I don't know what Kathy has done, but most importantly, get that scan and find out whether or not she actually is a good candidate for the surgery. And I don't know whether that's been done. So I really can't give her as much advice as I would if I had that information. Our next email is from Thomas in Salinas. And Thomas writes, if you've not already, I was hoping you could share your thoughts on the long-term risks and side effects of taking finasteride to combat benign prostate hypertrophy. I just had a TURP. Now, folks, a TURP is a transurethral resection of the prostate. So think Roto-Rooter, that's the name, and that's a TURP going through your prostate. And I was hoping I could now discontinue after taking 5 milligrams a day for about a year. Doctor indicates that I should continue taking it. Now, I've been reading about the risks of liver and kidney damage as well as insulin resistance and other things that don't seem quite as dangerous. In Europe, finasteride is not prescribed long-term for these reasons. And so Thomas is worried, and I will say, in the spirit of full disclosure, that I had not done much reading about the post-finasteride syndrome, but I found an article talking about exactly that. And so let's go to, you know, what is the drug? It is a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor. So essentially what it does is it prevents a pair of molecular scissors from doing something. It's used for baldness at a very low dose, and for prostate hypertrophy at a dose about five times higher than that. And the adverse effects that I were aware of were, that I was aware of, were sexual dysfunction and mood alteration. But this other syndrome, post-finasteride syndrome, is sexual side effects, low libido, erectile dysfunction, depression, anxiety, and cognitive complaints. And another article that I came across looking at long-term use, titled "It's Time to Sound the Alarm," also mentioned a rise in non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is becoming an increasing cause of liver transplant, insulin resistance, dry eye disease, kidney dysfunction, and metabolic abnormalities. And that's because it's not just testosterone turning into dihydrotestosterone. It's the effects of that, of less dihydrotestosterone, which apparently acts in other areas. It's also possible that 5-alpha reductase is useful in other areas. We know, in fact, that it is, and that the finasteride blockage of that could have other downstream long-term side effects. Now, just getting back to Thomas's question, it really doesn't make a lot of sense to me that someone who's had a TURP would need to continue on this drug. I suspect that the immediate post-recovery period, and I'm not sure how many months that is, it would be sensible to keep the thing calm. But after that, I'd want to see some data that the long-term use of this is worthwhile, or whether this is just a, oh, it won't hurt you to keep taking it kind of idea on the part of the surgeon, which it certainly sounds like from a brief investigation of the medical literature is not necessarily so. I meant to start off with that. I'm going to bring that back, but that it ain't necessarily so theme, I mean. Our next story is kind of, let's just say it wins the No-Brainer of the Year award. In fact, as I'm reading this, I was thinking to myself, I may be one of the few doctors who prescribes semaglutide that actually emphasizes diet and exercise and frames this drug as a bridge to getting yourself to the point where you can actually go it alone. But that takes behavior change. But nothing motivates behavior change like losing some weight and actually finding it easier to move and having your energy increase. Well, people who take these GLP-1 drugs like Wegovy and semaglutide can lose as much as 10 to 20% of their body weight over 6 to 12 months. But over half of the users quit the drugs within a year, partly because of the drugs not being effective for them, but most commonly because of expense or side effects, of which GI side effects are fairly common. Once you quit, the pounds start creeping back. And what's really worrying is that the weight that people regain tends to be almost exclusively fat with very little muscle. So in the end, since your metabolic health, which is do you get diabetes and hypertension or not, effectively, your metabolic health depends upon your muscle to fat or your fat to muscle ratio. So a long-term study of people who used and quit one of the weight loss drugs suggests there may be a simple, accessible way to stave off unhealthy weight regain after stopping the drugs. You guessed it, exercise. So this was a study done at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, and they used an older drug, because this study was a few years ago, so they used one called Saxenda, which was liraglutide. It was an earlier GLP-1 medication, also made by Novo Nordisk, which is the company that makes Ozempic and Wegovy. And they had a So they started out with 195 Danish adults with obesity but no other illnesses. And they put them on an extremely low-calorie diet under the supervision of scientists to rapidly lose about 30 pounds. Then they moved them to the maintenance phase. And the maintenance phase was where they were taking GLP-1, this Saxena, the liraglutide. At the same time, they had a separate group of volunteers who also lost the weight, but they started the same drug. But in addition, they were put on a supervised exercise program in which they did twice weekly half-hour spinning classes and 15 minutes of high-intensity full-body resistance training, and then two at-home jogs or similar workouts. And being that this was a study, they actually had trainers observing them do these things. And this was very vigorous, strenuous exercise. And then they had a control group that didn't exercise or receive a placebo. And they told them eat right and exercise, which, surprisingly enough, is advice that's often ignored. So everyone who took the drug maintained the lower weight or lost more weight over the period that we're talking about. So it overcame the tendency to regain weight after having lost it on a crash diet. But those combining the drug and exercise lost more. They lost about 6 pounds more. And most of the pounds they lost consisted of fat instead of muscle. And that's very important. I want to just comment on one aspect of this study that I found a little bit disturbing, which is we know that rapid weight loss is bad for you. And part of the reason it's bad for you is because when you lose fat, you basically bathe your blood in environmental pollutants that you have absorbed over the years and stashed away nice and safe in the closet in your fat, where they are doing you no metabolic harm and are not overloading your liver or your kidneys. When you dump a bunch of that into the bloodstream, essentially, you're overloading the sewers and you're not going to get rid, things are going to back up and hang around longer than they should and maybe do some damage. In fact, probably do some damage because these are compounds that are fat soluble. And so one of the things they're going to do is they're going to go into other parts of body fat. Well, guess where the rest of your body fat is outside of your body fat? It's in the lining of your nerves. So your nerves are going to take a hit and your brain, also largely fat, is going to take a hit. So let's go a year forward. And the researchers brought everybody back to the lab. Well, they got 109 who came back out of the 195. And they checked their body weight, body composition, current exercise habits. And what they found was kind of discouraging. Those who'd taken the weight loss drugs without exercise regained 70% or more of the weight. And most of the regained pounds were in the form of fat, not muscle. So they ended up with higher percentage of body fat, and they were also tired. So they weren't exercising even as much as they'd been before because they were more tired. Those who'd exercised while taking the drug had maintained much more of their weight loss, and they remained at least 10% lighter than at the study's start. And if they did regain weight, most of it was muscle. So that actually gave them a healthier body composition. And most of them were still exercising. The ones who had been exercising were exercising even without supervision. And they had basically gone from what they were previously doing to about two hours of workout a week. Not as vigorous. So what part of this do we not understand? All of the things that help people lose weight, right? Exercise, change in diet. And in my view, altering the microbiome. If you are overweight and eat a diet that one would anticipate would make you overweight, or volumes that would of healthy food that will make you overweight because you are, you have an imbalance between your energy input and your energy output. And that results in stored energy, also known as fat. The microbiome turns out to be critical in terms of diet. And so one of the things that I really want to emphasize here is the other stuff, not just the drug that gets you to the weight that's your goal weight, but the stuff that's going to help you stay there. Exercise is super important. Fiber, 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 and more fiber, because that's what feeds your microbiome. Adequate fluids, please, because when you're thirsty, you think you're hungry and you're going to eat more, and that's a factor. Your satiety will not, you will eat more, you will outrun essentially your satiety hormones. And by the way, sleep and stress are key here. Not only does stress raise your cortisol, but you need vagal tone, which is relaxed. You need to be in a relaxed, ready-to-digest state when you eat in order to release GLP-1, which is one of the main satiety hormones. So everything is connected. It's all in the loop. And your behavior really matters, not just what you put in the mouth, but the circumstances of what you're thinking and whether you feel safe and whether you are stressed when you do it all have an effect on your ability to maintain your weight. And oh, did I mention exercise? That's important too. We're going to do another email at this point. This one from an anonymous writer in Santa Cruz who writes, help with healing and clearing fungus. Hi, Dr. Dawn. When the rains hit, I became very cognitively impaired. Tests show that I have high mycotoxins internally. I also have leaky gut and SIBO. All of my symptoms with these are only cognitive, with bloating and distension. I've been doing a natural approach to small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, as well as nutritional supplements for my candida and mycotoxin. I recently started taking Saccharomyces boulardii. I thought I heard you say a while back on your show that when one takes this, one should not be taking other antifungal supplements or meds. Did I hear this right? I'd greatly appreciate it if you could address this in terms of the supplement protocol for what I mentioned above. I won't go into everything I've been taking, but I recently added a black seed oil supplement. That's probably a Nigelia, which is also called black seed. And it's an herb. It's a seed that has antimicrobial properties for the audience. Anonymous is looking for guidance, but I have to go all the way back to the way that Anonymous framed the question, because you can have high mycotoxins internally, and I'll talk about that testing in a second, and most of the mycotoxins are actually not inside your gut, but I should say most of the fungi that are producing the fungal toxins, which is what a mycotoxin is, most of those fungi may not, in fact, be inside your gut. They may be actually in your immediate environment. I had a conversation once with Randy Shoemaker, who's one of the grandfathers of natural fungal medicine, and he was very dismissive about anyone who lives in Northern California. He challenged our group. If you can find someone who doesn't test positive for mycotoxins in Northern California, I want to find them because, hey, it's moist here. There's lots of mold. There's lots of forests. Forests create mold. Soil has mold. Leaf duff has mold. So we live in an intrinsically moldy environment in this part of the world. So when you do a mycotoxins test, I would love if they would normalize it to our area, because very evidently most of us do not have a toxin-related illness. Life expectancies here are no shorter. The sorts of things that you might expect to occur with mycotoxins are no more prevalent from an epidemiological standpoint. So clearly we're mostly handling it. That doesn't mean there aren't people who don't handle it. So first of all, the toxins themselves are different than an allergy, and people always get this confused. An allergy is where you are reacting to the surface of a compound. The surface itself is generating an immune reaction because of molecular mimicry, because of mistaken identity, because your immune system has formed antibodies against it. That's an allergy. A toxin is a poison. You know that, right? And a lot of various fungi actually make and secrete these toxins. They get, and they're volatile, so they float in the atmosphere. It's a bit like that lactic acid in the earlier study that we were having with respect to the endometriosis. The lactic acid is a byproduct of bacterial metabolism. These toxins are byproducts of the fungi's physiology itself. And we use a lot of fungal byproducts as drugs. They're quite interesting molecules, and they can definitely mess with our bodies, our liver, and our brains. So some of what's out there is undoubtedly in the surrounding environments. And in fact, you nailed it. When the rains hit, I became cognitively impaired. Well, it's wet on the outside. Your gut is just as wet on the inside, whether it's raining or not. But what happens is that you get a toxin bloom with the rain, and that's you get a fungal bloom, and that creates a flare of toxins, just like when the dinoflagellates in the ocean have a bloom and you get a red tide and the waves are all pretty and phosphorescent at night and toxic to the surfers in the daytime. That's a mold bloom at work, or a fungal bloom at work in our houses. You swallow some as you breathe. That's going to end up some of it in your gut. You're going to some of it'll be in your caught in your mouth and swallowed. Some of it'll go into your lungs, and because these are tiny molecules, potentially be absorbed. So I really want to encourage Anonymous to get a magnifying glass and a bright light and start hunting for sources of mold and fungi in your environment. And like, for example, you can put down plastic if your house, for example, is on dirt and you've got dirt and maybe a wooden floor or, you know, subflooring and carpeting. Those toxins can come from the soil and get up. So you can put plastic down there and reduce that a little bit. But you should, if you don't find anything, take off the light switches and the electric outlets and swab around in there. See if something smells really musty that comes back on your Q-tip. That would be a sign that you've got some mold behind the drywall. Drywall is kind of a joke in an old house because, you know, the plumbing leaks and it's now damp wall and a perfect source of fungus. So I know I'm creeping you all out, but the truth is, this can make you sick. Some people really don't handle it well. And there are things you can do, dehumidifiers, retardant agents like, spraying white vinegar on surfaces periodically. Excellent antifungal therapy. And aside from the smell, pretty harmless to humans. You can also get ERMI testing, ERMI. And if you own your house, you want to recognize that any leaks that you've had will have created mold in the drywall. And the question is, have you dried that out? Or has it not been able to dry out? ERMI testing is environmental testing for mold spores. It does not really tell you about toxins. We don't have a test for that. But where there are spores, there are probably toxins. Now, it depends whether you're a renter or an owner. If you're an owner, you want to tell the person doing the ERMI testing to swab the baseboards because that's where you're going to get a realistic idea of what's going on. If you are a renter, then the person you're renting from sort of has skin in the game. They don't want to find that they have a lot of mold in their home because then they are on the hook for the amelioration of that. So you might want to get your own ERMI tester either way and swab the baseboards. And then we come to, okay, so if you think you have mold toxins, first you look in the environment, you reduce the levels as much as you can. You take steps to dry spaces out, and when the rains hit, you dehumidify like crazy to the greatest extent you can. And certainly using air filters like HEPA filters is very beneficial in this circumstance, because they do filter out some of the toxin, not all of it, because it's very small, but some of it, and a little bit's better than none. We'll get just briefly into things that you can do behaviorally that help your body get rid of toxin. And one of them is a prescription drug used to lower cholesterol called cholestyramine, which is just a sponge for toxin, causes GI side effects, but you figure out the dose that you can tolerate and you take it and you reduce your body burden of toxins, and it's harmless because it isn't absorbed into your system. All it could do is cause GI side effects, which can be dealt with over-the-counter remedies, and worth the effort. The Ayurvedic technique of oil pulling, which I've never done it. It sounds like it would be hard to do, but the idea is that you take a pure oil. Usually coconut oil is used, but other oils can be used as well, but it's going to be a tasteless oil. You put it in your mouth and you swish it around for like 20 minutes and then you spit it out. And when you spit it out, you've essentially created a kind of oil dialysis, because a lot of your blood flow goes through your cheeks and your saliva. So you've captured the oil lipid soluble compounds in this oil, and when you spit it out, you're spitting out stuff that otherwise would have settled in your body fat. Like when we were talking before about rapid weight loss, this is how stuff gets into that body fat. Another thing is sweating. So saunas, or if you can't afford or don't have a sauna, taking a hot bath with magnesium sulfate, which is Epsom salts, really help you sweat. And when you finish with your soak, you should try to have, there should be sweat pouring off your face and your hair should be damp with sweat. And then you do a rinse. Doesn't have to be a cold rinse, but you want to rinse immediately with the shower head so that you get those off of your body and then out of the tub and dry off. And doing that at least every couple of days is going to help reduce toxins. Now, I've gone far afield of Anonymous's original question. So when you're taking an antimicrobial and a microbial that you want, like the Saccharomyces boulardii, which is technically a fungus, or a yeast rather, and don't ask me the difference between a fungus and a yeast, because honestly, I don't remember. But they're close enough and they're in the same family. So since we play a lot of rock and roll on the station, I'm going to say good enough for a rock and roll station. And take it at the opposite time of day. So if you're taking black seed oil, oregano, rosemary, thyme, undeclinic acid, bearberry, I mean, there's dozens of things that you might be taking, but take them apart from your S. boulardii, and consider taking a probiotic, although you did say you have SIBO and you have to be really careful with bacterial probiotics in SIBO. So forget I said that. I probably shouldn't give you that advice, but I think I can tell you this, that the S. boulardii is going to be good for you because it will at least crowd out any candida that might be hanging around. And I'm assuming that your candida diagnosis is not from symptoms, but that you actually got tested and know that you have it, because there's a lot of people who come into my office saying, I've got candida, I want help with my candida, and I test them and I can find no DNA in their stool for candida. So they've just extrapolated from symptoms, which one of the things you learn in your first year of medical school is that just because the symptoms match doesn't mean you've made the diagnosis. Okay, time for one more email and then we'll see what we've got left. This from Judy in Madison, I think probably Wisconsin. Judy writes, thank you so much for addressing my recent query about romosozumab. That was last week, folks, and this was a new drug for osteoporosis that I was feeling was probably only really for people with severe osteoporosis due to the fact that it was new and super, super expensive. And I didn't even know whether Judy needed a drug. So she wanted to answer some questions I asked on the air. So this is a follow-up email. I stopped taking Fosamax in 2011 after learning about osteonecrosis and weird femur fractures. Since then, I was monitoring my bone density scores over 5 years, but I didn't see any change in my density scores while I took it. So I've not taken it since. My right femoral T-neck score is minus 2.5. So I had told her to go get a FRAX score. It shows a 10-year probability of a major osteoporotic fracture is 17%, and the hip is 5.8%. I'm very inclined to keep up with my physical activity without medication. Looking at 17% and 5.8%, Judy writes, if I saw either of these as the probability of rain in the forecast, I would not take an umbrella with me. Would you consider discussing how to interpret probability percentages in a FRAX computation? At what percentage would you advise taking medication? The report is from a diagnostic lab that says it did not compute the FRAX score. She's talking about the DEXA score, I think. That report is from a diagnostic lab that says it did not compute the FRAX score due to osteoporosis. Ridiculous is my answer to that. Lawyer talk. So we're going to pause on Judy and take this call. Hello, this is Dr. Dawn. You're on the air. Tell me your name and why you're calling.
This is Sarah, and I can't hear you at all, but I'm very glad to ask you questions. So my question is about SIBO. And how do you go about preparing to get rid of it or getting rid of it if you can't take Allicin, you can't take berberine?
Okay, well, there's a lot of other things you can take. I was just listing some of them. I don't know if you caught that. All right. I'm going to have to sign off here and just say that the way one prepares for treating SIBO is fairly straightforward. In the sense that first you have to figure out why you have it. Sometimes that's just because you are stressed, you're not making enough stomach acid or other digestive enzymes. So the first step is to start taking those. The second step is to look at the person's surgical history and to consider if there could be a reason that they're not clearing their small intestine of bacteria that's climbing up from the colon. The next thing we do is identify what bacteria are there and whether there's a lot of fungus in the mix, because the treatments are based on the bacteria that we diagnose. You can find a lot of people can give themselves SIBO by taking super high doses of probiotics, but it's usually temporary because the body fixes itself. So chronic SIBO that doesn't respond, you know, obviously you have a reason that this is coming back. Just like mold in a poorly ventilated space, it's the environment that's permissive. And so you need to take steps to improve gastric motility, make sure that you keep everything moving through. Sometimes we use acupuncture, Ayurveda, other massage therapies to try and ensure that things are moved. I've even gone so far as to use erythromycin, an antibiotic, at night, or Reglan, an old pro-motility drug, to make sure that things move through the system, because that's really one of the main causes of SIBO. Now, just to spend the last couple of minutes going back to Judy's question, and Judy is right, what are the odds? And so I just want to explain what a FRAX score is. First of all, you take the bone mineral density, and then you look at the number of additional risk factors that a person has. And the risk factors are like your age, do you smoke, Did anyone, do you drink a lot of booze? Did anyone in your family have a fragility fracture? That's a strong risk factor. And so people with weak risk factors, you know, family history is the biggest risk factor. And that's because it's not just bone density, it's microstructure, and that you inherit. So bad microstructure, we can't see it, but we know it's there in the statistics. So another thing that's super important to realize is that a hip fracture doesn't kill you. And by the way, the major osteoporotic fracture, that can include a wrist fracture, a forearm fracture, or an arm fracture, and those simply don't kill you. And they hurt for a while and heal. A spinal fracture, which is also a major osteoporotic fracture, is a pancake fracture, and those can be large and small and are often clinically silent. So really what we want to look at is what will kill you, and that is a hip fracture. And that, seriously, you're going to have surgery for a hip fracture, and whether you die or not depends on how old you are and how sick you are when you get that fracture, not on the fact that you got the fracture. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.